With the future of Afghanistan on the agenda at the NATO summit in Chicago this weekend, we want to spend a few minutes now on one incident from the war there. It's the story of a suicide bombing last month that took the life of Marine Master Sergeant Scott Pruitt, a military accountant from Mississippi. What happened to him and the other Marines he was with plays out in a dramatic series of photographs taken by Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Phillips. Phillips was riding with them when their convoy was attacked by a man with a pushcart loaded with explosives and ball bearings. You can see the photos and read Michael's story at hereandnow.org as he joins us from NPR in Washington. And Michael, you were in a town called Zarang near the border with Iran. What happened?
We were in pickup trucks, which is really unusual in Afghanistan. Of course, mostly U.S. troops go in heavily armored vehicles when they move around outside of the big bases. Because there's no U.S. presence in Zarang most of the time, they were traveling around in Afghan police vehicles, which are Ford Rangers, no armor, sort of thing you'd see on the road in the United States. There were four vehicles in that convoy. The Marines were piled in the back, in the beds or in the seats in front. And we were driving along what's called Route 9 or Highway 9 from the Iranian border into the town of Zarang. It was a commercial area. The kids were out, which is usually a good sign. People were waving. And
because if the kids are out, then you would think there wouldn't be danger. The adults would have brought them in.
Exactly. It's a classic, you know, sign of danger when the children disappear. And the kids were out. The adults were out. People were doing business. There were barbershops and stores, the normal kind of stuff. And then it happened.
A blast.
Exactly. I was sitting in the lead pickup truck in the bed, facing backwards, sitting on a toolbox, and I had my camera in my lap, and we were about, you know, 30 yards, maybe 40 yards ahead of the second pickup truck, and it just disappeared. It just was a extremely loud explosion, a column of smoke. All I could see, I remember looking back, and I could see the silhouette of the hood of that pickup truck flying through the air, and I couldn't make out anything else. And when I looked back, I just assumed that everybody in that vehicle was dead.
On the Wall Street Journal website, there's a slideshow of the aftermath of that bomber, and it plays out almost in real time as you narrate it. So presumably you were snapping photos constantly. Was that your automatic response as a photographer, even after having been so close to a bombing?
Yeah, like I said, I was sitting in the bed of the pickup truck, and I had my camera around my neck and on my lap, and I just started shooting pictures. You know, I'm really a reporter, not a photographer, but I use photos both for stories and as a reporting tool to help me remember what scenes look like sometimes. And so I just started shooting. The Marines and I jumped out of the vehicle and made our way back towards the stricken pickup truck. I shot pictures as I went, and then, you know, we all also had to deal with the casualties and that sort of thing as well. But when I wasn't doing that, I'd just take more pictures, and I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I hope these are in focus.
So you were simultaneously helping the wounded and snapping shots?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, one of the Marines who was in the bed of the vehicle, Sergeant Caleb Rauscher from New York, was thrown out. He had shrapnel wound in his side, burns on his arm, and really just got his head knocked really badly. I think probably when he landed, but I'm not sure. And so he was down on the road. Master Sergeant Pruitt, who was the most seriously wounded, mortally so, was sort of trapped inside the vehicle. And so some of the Marines were trying to get to him. Lieutenant Gabe Skanga was trying to drag Sergeant Rauscher off the street. And he was just too big to move alone. So he and I pulled him together. He was, frankly, still too big for the lieutenant and me to move on our own. Fortunately, another Marine came and did the heavy lifting with the lieutenant and pulled him all the way off to the side of the road.
One of the injured Marines, Sergeant Caleb Rauscher, plays into what, for me, was one of the most powerful parts of what you wrote, which is that you were trying to help him. He's bloody and bruised and looks stunned. He asks you what happened. You tell him what happened. A few seconds later, he says, "What happened?" You tell him again. And this keeps repeating. He couldn't retain the memory of what you were telling him. Clearly, he was very wounded, even if it wasn't immediately clear what had happened. How is he doing now?
He is back. They evacuated him pretty much immediately to a hospital in Kandahar and then moved him from there to Germany from Germany to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and now he's in New York with his family and being treated at the VA. The military at the moment does not consider him ready yet to rejoin his unit. He has traumatic brain injury from the either from the explosion itself or from landing on the street. So he was, but in that moment, he was very confused. And as you said, he couldn't keep things in his head for more than 10 or 15 seconds. So he would ask me the same question over, is my face burned? Is everybody okay? He was very concerned about everybody else. What happened? And then he would just repeat the same questions over and over, no matter what I said. So I just kept answering the same way and hoping that it would sink in.
The Marine who was killed, as we said, is Sergeant Scott Pruitt. Would you tell us a bit about him, where he was from, and what family he leaves behind?
Master Sergeant Pruitt is from, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Gautier, Mississippi. He is an accountant. He'd been in the Marine Corps for 19 years, was looking forward to putting in his retirement papers the week after this patrol went out. He had two little girls, a four-year-old and a nine-year-old. He was engaged to be married to another accountant who worked for the military as well. You know, he's a guy who... He was very, very, very funny, very likable, a natural accountant, and he used to travel around. Carrying a big bag of a big Ziploc bag full of candy canes to give to the kids that he'd find along the way. And the day before this all happened, we were at the governor's guest house in Zaranj, which is where the Marines were staying since they have no base there. And one of the government official's sons, who's a 5-year-old. Was running around his dad's office, basically. And Master Sergeant Pruitt had a box of Crayolas and a coloring book, Sesame Street characters. And he sat there in the most diligent way. The two of them sat there sharing this coloring book, you know, drawing in Elmo and I don't know who else, the other characters.
He himself was doing some of the coloring.
He himself, he did one page and the little boy named Shams did the other. And I took a picture of them, and I remember stopping the little boy as he was walking away from that and asking about his picture, you know, in our non-communicative, non-overlapping language kind of way. And he showed me the picture that Master Sergeant Pruitt had done and how he'd colored it in, and then he had signed it Scott and put the date on it. And the little boy was very happy with that. And, you know, 24 hours later, he was dead.
Michael Phillips is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You can see his photos of the aftermath of a suicide bombing in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. By the way, Marine Master Sergeant Scott Pruitt was buried at Arlington National Cemetery on May 8th. Michael, you say now you're not sure if you're remembering that day or just the photos you shot. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it was such a jolting experience. You know, the world explodes and suddenly everything is thrown into chaos. And, you know, my reaction was to take pictures and report. And some of the things that I saw in my pictures, I don't remember having seen. There's one shot of Captain Julie Hartshorn, a female Marine who dropped to her knee and was aiming. After the explosion, I probably should have mentioned this, there was an ambush and insurgents opened fire on the scene from different locations around the street. And I shot a picture of Captain Julie Hartshorn dropping to one knee and aiming back at one of the insurgent positions. In the background, you can see the badly damaged pickup truck. You can see Master Sergeant Pruitt in the front seat, just his outline. You can't see his face. I don't remember taking that picture. Obviously, I did, because there it is on the camera. But to a certain extent, when you're a reporter, your notebook or your camera is a filter between you and reality. It allows you to continue doing your job even as you should probably be running for cover. I think that that happened to such an extent in this incident that the pictures themselves are more solid than my memories of what happened. Not everything. I remember, you know, a good deal. But some of the details, really, I only noticed from the pictures.
So in the chaos of the moment, it took your photos to help you piece together how this played out.
That for me and also for the Marines. I mean, the Marines and I afterwards sat down and we went through these pictures together. And to a man, everyone said, oh, yeah, that's what happened. Or, oh, that must be me in that picture. Or that's somebody else. And oh, that's what we were doing at that moment. it really helped prompt the memories, particularly those who had traumatic brain injury, TBI, the guys who were in the vehicle itself. You know, they really had their memories prompted by these photos. They found it very therapeutic to look at them as did I, but mostly I found them really helpful for writing a story.
Michael Phillips is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. You can see his pictures taken immediately after a suicide bombing in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Michael, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
As NATO leaders gather in Chicago this weekend to talk about the future of Afghanistan, there are concerns about what will happen in that country when foreign troops leave. The BBC's Andrew North reports that the transition to Afghan control of the war is already taking a toll on local businesses.
The methodical sound of the Kabul Mili boot factory earlier this year. Hundreds of workers used to cut, glue and sew combat boots here for the Afghan army under a multi-million dollar contract paid for by the US and NATO. They hailed it as one of their big success stories in buying locally and creating Afghan jobs. But now the work has stopped. The Afghan Defence Ministry has now taken over the business of buying military supplies and it's ended Kabul Mili's contract. At the factory, as they pack finished boots for storage, there are fears NATO's policy of buying Afghan first is being dropped in favour of cheaper boots from China.
If the money comes to Afghan manufacturers, it is good for the future of Afghanistan. And that means success of the country.
Fahad Safi is the director of the boot factory.
We were given a chance through the US government and we made it. We shown them that Afghanistan can make quality product.
So what do you think this says, the fact that now the contract has been taken away? What does this say about the future of Afghanistan?
Now you can see the future, what is happening. From 150 workers of the boot section, only 38 was left. In the near future, maybe in 1 or next 2 months, 38 workers will be also sent back home.
So all 150 will
have Yes, gone. Yeah. And the factory will be closed.
Arguably, stopping buying boots from this factory is a sign of the Afghan government standing on its own feet. Saving money before the foreign funding on which it relies starts to dry up. But there are very few large factories like this in Afghanistan. So it's not a good sign for the future if it can't keep this place open. Afghan officers organising a handout of new uniforms for their troops. But the Defence Ministry dismisses reports they'll now start buying more from abroad. Spokesman General Zahir Azimi says Afghan equipment will still be the first choice where possible.
If two different companies provide the same piece of equipment, we'll give the contract to the Afghan company, even if the quality is slightly lower.
My name is Hamidullah Farooqi and I'm a professor at the Kabul University, academic faculty.
The professor worries about how Afghanistan is going to pay, not just for its security forces as NATO starts pulling out, but for all its needs.
Our calculation says we are in great need of foreign aid for about $7 to $10 billion per year. Otherwise, very severe consequences, probably, you know, the collapse of the economy. If we get enough support from international community, probably we're gonna still have drawdown of our economic growth by 4 to 5%, and that will bring our growth rate from 9% average in past 10 years to maybe 3 to 4%.
Having been kicked out of boot making, the Kabul Mili factory has been left with stacks of leather and other raw materials worth millions. There's another risk, though, if the workers being laid off can't find new jobs. This man is one of the last to go from the boot factory, but he told us if he can't find new work, he's going to join the Taliban. As NATO pulls its boots out of Afghanistan, keeping Afghan boots on the ground here may be far more important than many realize.
That report from the BBC's Andrew North in Afghanistan.